I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Final resort. Without a last-minute reprieve, Texas inmate Robert Roberson will be executed tomorrow for the death of his young daughter. The case against him was built on a now debunked theory of shaken baby syndrome. A lawyer with the Innocence Project tells us she can only hope Governor Greg Abbott intervenes before it's too late.
And attention, Kmart shoppers. The last remaining full-size store is closing down for good. A Kmart superfan reflects on the end of a shopping era and on the tattoo she got commemorating the store.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Support comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital in Grand Rapids, offering rewarding careers in healthcare with open positions available at granditasca.org/careers. Grand Itasca, where you're treated like family. During the Coming Home to KAXE Fall Membership Drive, KXE are holding trivia nights Thursday, October 24th in Bemidji and Grand Rapids. The 6 p.m. events are at Bemidji Brewing and Clockout Brewing in Grand Rapids. All are welcome. Support comes from Timberlake Lodge in Grand Rapids, offering an endless soup and salad bar for lunch and burgers and hand-cut steaks for dinner. Online at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Mississippi Headwaters Audubon Society and Conservation Minnesota present a workshop on light pollution and its effects on wildlife Sunday, October 20th from 1 to 4 at the Nielsen Spearhead Center, southwest of Bemidji. The session includes building bat boxes. Now I'm going to play a song for you. It's a new tune from Waxahachie. It's called Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh,
And that's Much Ado About Nothing by Waxahachie.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
death blow. Israel confirms it has killed the Hamas leader who planned the October 7th attacks. But our guest in Tel Aviv says Yahya Sinwar's death will not end Hamas or the war.
Dear Justin, amid reports that Liberal MPs are drafting a letter demanding Prime Minister Trudeau's resignation, we'll ask PEI MP Sean Casey how the revolution's going.
Disorderly conducting, Finland mourns Leif Segerstam, a conductor who was a hero in his homeland and a composer who was known for refusing to compose himself.
Unprecedented developments. It's been weeks since Cameroon's 91-year-old president was last seen, but our guest says the people she's most concerned about are the journalists reporting on his health.
Playing through, a golfer with autism who just made history with his latest win describes the pride of overcoming not just his opponents, but also the bullies on and off the course.
And a star is boring. Mattel is planning an entire movie centered around the Viewmaster, a toy that showed 3D pictures but still lacked depth. As it happens, the Thursday edition, radio that can already see the sequel and assumes it'll be kaleidoscopic. Israel says it has killed the architect of the deadly October 7th attacks, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that doesn't mean the war is over. Today, Israel's foreign minister confirmed that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar was killed in a ground operation in Rafah. It said there were no signs that there were any hostages present in the building. Yahya Sinwar ordered the attack on October 7th, 2023, that killed 1,200 people and saw 250 taken hostage. In the year since, Israel's retaliation has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians in Gaza. Yossi Melman is the author of multiple books on Israeli intelligence and an analyst for the newspaper Haaretz. We reached him in Tel Aviv.
Yossi, obviously it's late right now in Tel Aviv, but I wonder what your sense is of the reaction to this news, what you've been hearing around you.
Israel is in a euphoric mood, most Israelis. And probably rightly so, because the leader of Hamas, Yahya Sinwar, was a cruel enemy of Israel. By the way, he spent 22 years in an Israeli jail, not for killing Israeli Jews, but actually killing his Palestinian brothers, whom he accused of being collaborators with the Israeli intelligence, Israeli authorities. So in that sense, I think it's a closure since October the 7th. Certainly the Israeli leadership, politically and militarily, would exploit it for their own either political or security gains.
Will the euphoria last?
I doubt it, because while we are speaking, the Israeli military just announced something which we had known before, for a couple of hours, that five Israeli soldiers, servicemen, were killed yesterday in Lebanon. And the number of the Israeli casualties is climbing. We have seen it. We have been there. The euphoric mood is going to be eased sooner or later, and we would return to the reality that the war is still going on and there is no end in sight.
Back in September, Yossi, you wrote Sinwar was living on borrowed time. How was he able, do you think, to elude Israeli security forces for so long?
How he managed to elude the Israeli forces, it was very suspicious. He didn't trust, he trust very few people. He moved from one shelter to another. And at a certain point, he most of the time lived underground in the tunnels. And But the Israeli intelligence did not have a clue about his whereabouts. The fact that he was killed by chance. I mean, I also wrote that sooner or later he would have to, from time to time, to surface, to breathe a fresh air, to see the sunlight. And that's what happened. He surfaced with two of his associates, and by chance, an Israeli military operation, which was around, and they didn't know that it was Sinwar, opened fire on these three terrorists, and then after some sort of laboratory examinations, they compared DNA samples. He spent 22 years in an Israeli jail, so Israel had his DNA samples, and that's how he was killed.
So you're saying that they got lucky? This wasn't a strategic win?
Yeah. But everyone knew that sooner or later he would be killed, and also we knew that he would not escape, and he was carrying with him hand grenades. So he probably said, I would not let them to capture me, and I would fight to the end and maybe even commit suicide if they would try to get me.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, as you've likely been seeing and hearing, has been speaking since Sinwar's death was confirmed, that it was in fact him who was killed. And Netanyahu has said clearly the war is still not over. He did mention the hostages, vowing to return them to their families. What do you think happens next for those people who are still alive and still in captivity?
Nothing. More of the same. Netanyahu has no intentions to end the war as long as it would risk him staying in power. It's clear cut because there were so many opportunities to release the hostages, to have a deal which was offered, brokered by the United States, Egypt, Qatar, and every time Israel was reaching very close to the deal, he came up with excuses and explanations and new preconditions. So for him, the war is the aim.
When we talk about Sinwar's death, his role in Hamas, where does his death leave this group?
Well, it's a real blow to Hamas, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. But still, Hamas is well-rooted in the Palestinian society. It's an ideological, religious, fundamental, radical organization. And despite that Israel has beheaded, killed, assassinated so many Hamas leaders over the years, and still they have managed to survive, it means they are not going anywhere.
Yossi, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yossi Melman is an analyst for the newspaper Haaretz. He's in Tel Aviv. The call is coming from inside the House. Not only do the polls of voters look bad for the Liberal Party and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, but increasingly he's facing pressure from within his own party. A group of around 20 caucus members are reportedly drafting a letter to Mr. Trudeau calling for him to step down as leader. And today came a report that four cabinet ministers will not be running for re-election. Earlier this week, the Liberal MP for Charlottetown, Sean Casey, was one of the first to publicly call for the Prime Minister to step down. We reached him in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador.
Sean Casey, yesterday you told our colleagues at CBC News PEI that you had not been in touch with those of your Liberal colleagues who are collecting signatures and want to urge the Prime Minister to step down as leader of the Liberal Party. You said you hadn't seen the pledge that they're working on either. Has anything changed?
Yes. I had a call with one of the group today. She read to me the document that they've been circulating. I advised her that I agreed with it, that they could add my name as a signatory. Mm-hmm. She indicated to me that the members of the group are trying to do this without fanfare and publicity at this point, until it comes to a head. Mm-hmm. And so I have to respect that. But the water on the beans has changed, yes.
How many signatures? Can you share that?
No, I can't, for two reasons. Before and after the call. Before the call, I didn't know, and I still don't.
Mm-hmm. I understand why you say you can't get into specifics. Certainly, there's a lot of knowledge about it already out there. We're hearing that, that things may come to a head at next Wednesday's caucus meeting. But how do you... Where does your confidence level sit in what this group of MPs are trying to do here?
It's more than me acting on my own. There's no question about that. But I'm not overly optimistic that this effort will succeed. It really depends on the force and volume of the support. Mm-hmm. But I am not optimistic. The Prime Minister seems extremely determined, and I know that many people would say, well, of course, that's the front he needs to present. I believe him.
Given what you've said there, is it not more harmful to your party to proceed with your colleagues on this, even if you have serious concerns about his leadership?
There's no question that if he stays, he will be weakened by this. There is no question that if he stays and he's weakened even more than he already is in the public eye, that's not good. I think we owe it to our constituents. I think we owe it to our party. I think we owe it to our country to make the effort, even if it's a long shot.
Have you heard anything from the Prime Minister or the Prime Minister's office since speaking out and being very clear and putting your name at the forefront of this?
Absolutely nothing. Mm.
The Globe and Mail is reporting that Ontario Liberal MP Chandra Arya wrote an email to the caucus saying a leadership race could be, quote, disastrous, and that it would, quote, fracture the fragile party structure. You know, historically, what can happen when a transition is not smooth and agreed upon. What do you say that this could be a disaster for your party ultimately?
I say that it's worth the risk. I think that it could be a disaster for our party if the Prime Minister stays on and the level of support that we have seen for the last year and a half plays itself out in the next election. Mm-hmm. So I agree that there is a risk to what we're doing. There is also a risk of doing nothing. Mm-hmm. I think the upside of taking this step, if it's successful, is significantly more than if we did nothing. It's a risk worth taking, in my view.
This is an unsettling time for you, it sounds like.
Sure is. I've been immensely fortunate to be able to serve as a member of Parliament under Justin Trudeau. History will be very kind to him. Voting is not always, in fact, almost never, a rational, logical exercise. It's based on emotion. And those emotions now are at a level where there's no turning back. So yeah, I'm not one bit happy about this, but this is what my constituents are telling me, and it's my job to voice it, and that's what I've done.
Is there enough time to find another leader before the next election?
I hope so. The window is closing, if it hasn't already completely closed. And it's a valid argument that we have run out of runway. The termination of the supply and confidence agreement and now the weekly confidence votes really have had a dramatic impact on the timing of this and on the force of the message that we're getting from our constituents.
Do you have someone in mind who you would like to lead the party?
Nope.
No idea? You must have preferences.
I know that there's a half a dozen people whose names are regularly reported in the media. What I will be looking for is someone who can inspire.
At this point, is there anything that Justin Trudeau could say or do that would change your mind or your constituents' minds, it sounds like?
My constituents' view is way more important than mine. I'm simply a conduit to deliver that message. And the answer to that is I highly doubt it.
You said at the outset of our conversation that you don't think that this list of signatures, this pledge will make him step down as leader. I mean, as you know, even if everybody in the caucus signed that letter, he could still ignore it if he chose to. So if the Prime Minister is listening right now and you have his ear, what is your pitch to him about why he should listen to what you and the other signatories are saying?
History will be very kind to you, Prime Minister. Your legacy is secure. It's in the best interest of the country. It's in the best interest of the party. And it's none of my business, but it's probably in the best interest of your family that you move along. You will be treated very kindly in the history books for the transformational changes and improvements you've made in this country. I and the people that I represent would like you to consider that and do the right thing.
Sean Casey, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Sean Casey is the Member of Parliament for Charlottetown PEI. We reached him today in St. John's. Leif Segerstam thought of music like no one else did, and with his baton in hand, the Finnish conductor and composer resembled no one else. Well, he sort of resembled Santa, except less twinkly and more turbulent, as you'll be able to hear. Obviously, Mr. Segerstam didn't hold back, not in his creative pursuits or in his interactions with musicians. He also didn't hold back when it came to composing, writing some 371 of what he called symphonies. Mr. Segerstam died last week at the age of 80 after a brief bout of pneumonia. Patrick Garvey was his agent. We reached him in Devon, England.
Patrick, that sounds electric, certainly. His own spin. I can hear you laughing. Is that a pretty good indication of what he was like?
It was the wonderful way in which he could recreate and create what the composer probably meant. But, of course, when Rimsky-Korsakov wrote that, he probably wasn't allowed to do things like that.
He conducted orchestras and opera in Finland and across Europe and the United States as well. For those who haven't seen him up close or heard him working with the orchestras in the pit, what do you think made him stand out, apart from the screaming?
Well, he was a genius. He was a giant of music. He encompassed so many aspects of music and life. He was a tremendous cook, for example. Oh. I don't know, he just encapsulated everything. Yeah. And then he channeled it. And he was truly an artist. He would almost recreate a score, but he was still faithful to what the composer had written.
That's a difficult thing to execute.
Well, it takes a lot of talent.
Yeah. What did he cook for you, since he was such a great cook?
Well, there was a wonderful evening in Helsinki where I walked to his house and we had a meal and rather a lot of alcohol. The next morning, I had a meeting with the Helsinki Philharmonic and the manager of the orchestra took one look at me and said, "You've been laifed."
He had a reputation.
Oh, yes.
So was the cooking actually good, or was it just you had so much alcohol you thought it was good?
Well, it was certainly good before the alcohol.
Okay.
I was very glad that I'd taken note of how to walk from the hotel so I could walk back to it.
Good plan of attack there. So there's the musical genius, the bon vivant that he was, clearly, the personality, his appearance as well. We want to give our listeners another idea of how he saw music, but also the world.
My technique is life. It is the life. You have to motivate the sound. Music is not that which sounds. Music is why that which sounds. Sounds like it sounds, when it sounds. We try to get the bench musicians to contact like satellites docking to the mothership on the estrade, altar. And then the music is starting to happen. And music is life, and life is music.
Even if people are familiar with what he said at the end, music is life and life is music, everything else he said is certainly a different way of describing things and looking at things, Patrick. How did that reveal itself in how he approached the music?
His power of imagination and realization. If you look at the number of symphonies he wrote, or the things that are called symphonies, and you look at the titles, you will automatically get a feel for how his spirit could reach out and take note of things that were of interest to him. And you can see how vast his network of thinking was. Yet, when it came to music, he would pull it into a very tight focus and then let it grow like a flower.
When we talk about how many compositions he put together, close to 400 of them, what did he tell you about what motivated him, what drove him to create so much?
I think it was principally, I don't know because he never told me, but I would say that what drove him was just his power of creativity. And that went on right to the end of his life. It never stopped. Right to the end, he would hear notes in conversations, which he would want, he would wish to express it by writing a piece of music around it.
There's a bit of a funny story that he told a Finnish interviewer when he was asked about how prolific he was.
well, he told me as well. At one point he said to me, well, there are so many of them, it's like a sperm. One of them might find the egg.
He thinks differently.
Yeah, well, speaking for myself, I like that.
Yeah. Does the classical world, the world of classical music and conducting, allow for more Leifs out there?
No. Someone like George Zell, the famous conductor of the Cleveland Orchestra for a long, long time, he wouldn't be allowed to operate now. This ability to tell people what to do with no argument and be a dictator is completely unacceptable. Leif was nothing like that, but he did say what he wanted without thinking necessarily diplomatically.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because people have said he could be abrasive. Finnish conductor Hannu Lintu told the New York Times, quote, I was afraid of him. He could say weird, insulting things. I admired him, but I didn't want to spend time with him, unquote. Was he difficult to be around? What was he like as a client?
Well, you've got to remember that in the client relationship, I am the junior partner. And an answer to that is that for the first few years, it was very difficult. But I was privileged to find myself eventually being trusted. And he sort of became a friend. So, you know, he wasn't a dictator. Far from it. And actually, the person underneath was absolutely lovely.
Well, Patrick, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Well, it's been lovely speaking to Canada again. Take care of yourself. Good night.
Patrick Garvey was Leif Segerstam's longtime agent. The Finnish composer and conductor has died. He was 80 years old.
This Halloween, one movie dares to ask the question. Are you the master of your Viewmaster? Or is the Viewmaster the master of view? That feels weird. I think it doesn't feel right. You know what I mean? Can we turn off the scary voice? It's just not...
I guess not. Okay. I'm sorry about that. Can we maybe... Let's maybe try some different music. Yeah, that's good. Sometimes the world seems two-dimensional, but it's all in how you look in things. Viewmaster, the movie. No. I mean, that can't be it either. Sorry, I know I keep doing... Let's just try one more approach. Sometimes the greatest adventures happen right before our eyes. This summer, enter the world of Viewmaster. Which is what, though? I mean, what is that world? Look, I'm sorry. We just have no idea what the Viewmaster movie could be. Nevertheless, Mattel says it's developing a four-quadrant family adventure film based somehow on the Viewmaster, a device that you put, you know, circular reels in and then you look in the eye holes of, and you see pictures in 3D. It's sort of fun, but it's not very fun. So what will the Viewmaster movie possibly be about? Well, Robbie Brenner, president of Mattel Films, says Viewmaster has inspired generations to embark on boundless adventures, offering a treasure trove of storytelling possibilities for this film. In other words, he also has no idea. Do you? If so, please let us and Mattel know, because it really feels like they are missing the big picture. Here's Alexandra Lost with East Coast 3D. Alexandra Lost with East Coast 3D.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we will bring you the case of Cameroon's missing president. He has not been seen for weeks, and our guest says just asking where he is can mean trouble.
And teeing off, if you haven't heard of the Australian golfer Stephen Alderson, you're going to want to hear this. After becoming the first autistic player to win a major international tournament, he has some things to say about overcoming both his opponents and the bullying he faced earlier in his life.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program, here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Alyssa Ellen. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Center Stage Minnesota celebrates the talents of Minnesota musicians Fridays at 2 and 10 p.m. with Malachi Coons. Find interviews with Minnesota artists like Cornbread Harris, Davina and the Vagabonds, and more. Weather tonight, mostly clear overnight, lows 45 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow, increasing clouds with a slight chance of rain in the afternoon. Highs near 68 Winds from the south, 5 to 15 miles per hour, gusting higher. Saturday, slight chance of showers, highs near 60.
He's 91 years old. He has ruled his Central African nation for over four decades, and he's nowhere to be found. Paul Biya, the president of Cameroon, was last seen in public in September. The only official explanation for his absence is that he, quote, granted himself a brief private visit to Europe, unquote. Last week, a cabinet minister announced that any media discussion of the absent leader's health was strictly forbidden and called on officials to monitor broadcasts and social media. That came after the government denied rumors that the president had died in a Paris hospital. Mimi Mefo-Neo is a freelance journalist from Cameroon and the founder of the online reporting network Mimi Mefo Info. She was briefly imprisoned in Cameroon in 2018 after reporting on the killing of an American missionary there. We reached her in Bonn, Germany.
Mimi, if you were still inside Cameroon working as a journalist there, would we be able to have this conversation safely, you and I?
The answer is no, because I have my reporters across the national territory, including the two conflicted northwest and southwest regions, and they got really, really scared after the territory administration minister, Paul Atanganji, banned private media as well as people from talking about the health of the president of the republic.
What kind of things are the reporters you work with telling you? You said they're scared, understandably. What are they describing to you about what they're still seeing and experiencing?
They won't be able to talk freely. They won't be able to write about what is happening in Cameroon, because the worst part is even ordinary Cameroonians scared to even comment about it. When we report it on our different platforms, you can see people in the comment section asking, oh, we are not allowed to talk about this. We are actually scared to report it. So many people are really worried. And with Cameroon's history of press censorship and crackdown on freedom of expression, you can imagine the feeling of fear that followed the statement from the minister.
And what kind of penalties would they face?
They could be tried in military court and sentenced to so many years in prison and asked to pay a lot of fines. And that is why you see many journalists now in behind bars. Reporters who are simply telling the stories of the people behind bars. And this law is actually being used to try them. And that was my case as well when I was in Cameroon in 2018. They used this law against me. And I was eventually arrested in 2018 and tried as well in a military court. So that's what people who try to express their freedom of expression, they suffer in Cameroon.
On the issue of the president's health, or whether he is even alive, Mimi, as you know, there are people who believe that the president is dead. What are your thoughts?
I wouldn't really want to comment on that because we don't want to speculate as journalists. Cameroonians, including myself, have not forgotten 2004. In 2004, there were similar speculations and there were even celebrations in Cameroon. People thought that the president has died, only for people to see him appear at the Simaleng Airport in Yaoundé. So 20 years down the line, many people are asking, could it be another stunt by the president? However, let's not forget that President Paul Biya now is 91 years old. And this is a different story altogether. So it's not 2004 when he was still a little bit younger. What I can say categorically is that I believe that the president is currently incapacitated. Also, the reaction of the government this time around is different. Actually makes me believe that there's more. So we see a lot of agitations within the camp of the ruling party, a lot of ministers trying to make statements. But then the real question, which is, where is the president, is not being answered.
And there's the matter of who is running the country and how that affects people in Cameroon just day to day.
Yeah, it's a big problem in Cameroon because there were always debates about Cameroon after Biya, what will happen. And everything in Cameroon now is centered around the president of the republic. There's conflict in the two English-speaking regions of Cameroon, and it started since 2016. You see teenage girls getting pregnant. You see young girls unable to go to school, teachers not able to go and teach to take care of their family from the salaries that they should be earning. That is the situation in the Anglophone regions of Cameroon. In the far north region, we have Boko Haram. We have schools that have been shattered by the militants. We have as well young women who give birth without ever seeing the four walls of the hospital. Even in places where there are hospitals, the situation is really, really terrible. You can't even believe that it's a hospital. Children go to school without classrooms. They study under the trees. That's how bad the situation is. So you begin to wonder whether the country is actually governed. Yeah. The answer is no from me.
And we should let our listeners know there's a legal successor, the president of the Senate. He is 90 years old himself. He also has not been seen in public for even a longer period than we're talking about in terms of the president. So given that state of leadership and everything you just said, what do you see in the next weeks and months for your country?
Well, we have ministers, young people ready to take over leadership and run the country. They are not just capable, they are willing, but they are not given the opportunity in Cameroon. Cameroon is a country governed by old, frail leaders. People who have been there for almost forever, people go on retirement and they are called back to office. That's how terrible the situation is. But then you ask about what will happen in Cameroon after. It's most likely to be chaos in Cameroon, particularly given how the CPDM has functioned. It has never been a real political party from my end, because not just talking as a journalist, I'm talking as an ordinary Cameroonians, as they turned it into President Paul Biya's fan club. As they hold all when they are holding their meetings, you see them, they've been able to, everything has been centered around President Paul Biya. And they also, there are also many factions within the party which could lead to serious infighting if he's no longer there. However, this present situation now, these questions around where is Paul Biya and seeing how Cameroonians are yearning for that change, is that opportunity, that one opportunity that the country has been waiting for. Their lack of clear strategy could be one thing that Cameroon needs to get a real transition and elect a president for the first time who will represent the aspirations of the people. So it's crucial at this point in time, but it's also an opportunity for the people to think about what kind of leadership they want. And if they are serious about it, if we as Cameroonians are serious about it, we'll get that kind of leadership that we want. It's possible and it's doable.
Mimi, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you as well for having me.
Mimi Mefoneo is a freelance journalist from Cameroon and the founder of the online reporting network Mimi Mefo Info. We reached her in Bonn, Germany. In British Columbia, campaign signs are everywhere you look. Lawns, street corners, shop windows, multiplying in clusters as the province's general election approaches on Saturday. And candidates get used to having their signs stolen or vandalized, and the NDP's Nathan Cullen is very familiar with the usual stuff that can happen when you plant your name and face on someone's lawn. But he was still shocked at one act of vandalism this campaign, when one of his signs, featuring his photo, was found along a highway hanging from a noose.
Someone went to a lot of effort in a very disturbing way. I think it's, well, beyond irresponsible. It's threatening. It's, I assume, meant to intimidate either me and people thinking about supporting me. I think either intentionally or unintentionally, it's also incredibly triggering. And that's what I've been hearing the last couple of days from folks that have had the horror of dealing with suicide in their families, and just that this can't be where our political conversation is going to. This campaign has been very strange, and we always lose a few signs. I've run a lot of campaigns in the Northwest, but we've lost more than 150 stolen, damaged, wrecked. We put a sign up, it gets destroyed that night, and it's You know, I normally don't worry about these things, Carolina. Like, you lose a few signs. I always tell my volunteers, don't worry about it. Let's just keep door knocking. But this year, it's been different. And while the doorstep remains really positive and people who, you know, very civilly disagree or say, no, Nathan, I'm not voting for you this time. Mm-hmm. That's all great. That's normal. But the online world, I would say, the social media world, and then this stuff is different. And it does trouble me, and I think it troubles a lot of people.
And this is not just an NDP experience. We've heard about candidates across the North from all different parties having their signs vandalized or torn down. You said it's a strange race. Why do you think this is happening?
Well, just because of that contradiction that, you know, I'm talking to people in the door, and, you know, they'll very, like I said, politely say, this issue bothers me, so I'm not going to vote for you, or go get them, put a sign up on my lawn. Normal. That's normal. We're very polite to each other. The worst I've had the whole campaign on the doorstep was, oh, hey, no, thank you. then that's very northern, right? We're going to have disagreements about things, but we're not going to be that way. But then you flip over to Facebook or Twitter, and if I could post that it's sunny and a beautiful day today, and the hateful comments that follow, I have to clean them out. Like, I have to say, please stop it. Like, we're just trying to have a conversation here. And I think folks, and then you turn to the signs. I mean, we've just had so many destroyed, like unprecedented, and it's very disturbing. It's very expensive. And this is, you know, we've got 2 days to the vote. This is the last thing I wanted to be talking about or expected to be talking about. I'd rather talk about all the other things that people are concerned about and how we can make a better future together. And that's ultimately what elections should be about.
BC NDP candidate Nathan Collin talking to Carolina DeReich, host of Daybreak North. In just a couple of weeks or so, American voters will decide who their next president will be. And that's not the only major decision they'll make in November. Among many choices on the ballot, several states will vote on abortion-related constitutional amendments. And in Nebraska, voters will decide on not one, but two separate measures. One of them would guarantee the right to an abortion until fetal viability. The other would enshrine the state's current 12-week ban and potentially open the door for even tighter restrictions. The opposing measures have caused confusion among voters, and according to abortion rights advocates, some of that is by design. Shelley Mann is with the group Nebraska Abortion Resources. We reached her in Omaha, Nebraska.
Shelley, I wonder what people in your circles are telling you about how they're feeling with the election so close now.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think it's just a lot of anxiety in general, and people kind of trying to navigate, you know, how they're going to tackle their ballot, and also combating a lot of the misinformation and things that are coming at them from all sides right now.
Confusion is a word that has come up in a lot of the coverage around Nebraska's vote and abortion on the ballot there. What kind of tactics are you talking about when you and others you work with say that there are deliberate actions being taken to confuse voters? What kind of tactics are you talking about?
Yeah, so we're the first state here in Nebraska to have two competing abortion ballot initiatives that both require a for and an against vote. So, you know, instead of having them up against each other where you're having to choose, you're having to vote for or against both of these initiatives, which means that it's possible for both of them to get across that 50% threshold to pass. So, you know, from the beginning of this campaign, it's been very confusing. We've seen the other side come out and, you know, putting out information that looks and makes their campaign out to be pro-choice in a way. So, you know, they, while collecting signatures to get this on the ballot, we had heard reports from folks that they had signage that said things like reproductive rights or human rights, or they were calling it the pro-choice initiative to folks, even though this would enshrine a 12-week ban into our Constitution. So that feels incredibly misleading. People came forward to have their name removed from that petition also. So, you know, that started things off on an interesting foot. And now that we're in the campaign phase, we're seeing things like video ads coming out where, you know, the video shows a doctor in black and white, and it says, "We want the government out of our healthcare decisions. Vote against 439, which is our initiative number. So vote against our fundamental right to abortion amendment." So, you know, it's definitely tricky, and I think it signals that there's some knowledge there that people really do support abortion access.
So how do you fight that in your work? What are you telling people about how to manage what they're going to see on their ballot when they go to vote?
We're trying really hard to get out there and just give people as much information we can about how to navigate the ballot. And I think that that's an enormous missed opportunity when we should be out there talking to people about the issue and, you know, giving them the information that they need to make an educated decision. It feels like now what we're being forced to do is spend our time helping people figure out which of the initiatives does what and how to find it on the ballot and how to vote. So really, we're out there trying to make sure that people know, you know, we want them to both vote against 434 and for 439, our initiative. And, you know, I really see that as a big failure on democracy.
You've been escorting women to abortion clinics for years now. If we talk about the current ban in your state, how has that played out there? What kind of effects have you seen?
We're seeing more people traveling out of state for care than ever. You know, more than 20% of the people who call the abortion fund here in Nebraska looking for care are having to go out of state to get it, to states like Minnesota or cities like Chicago, Denver. You know, after 12 weeks, we're having to send people out. But in addition to that, the shortage of appointments is causing people who even may not be over that 12-week threshold. The callers that are people who need care who are in the South, one of the first states that they get to as you head north is Kansas. They have three clinics, and then Nebraska's next. So, you know, we're seeing callers coming from other states. We're seeing our folks traveling out of state, and care is just getting steadily more expensive.
You're also often around people who disagree with you deeply, anti-abortion activists, many who set up camp outside clinics as well as doctors' offices. You've shared videos on your social media as well. How do you deal with those interactions, those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been really interesting since the ballot initiatives came forward, because the people who are setting up shop outside of the abortion clinic and who are harassing our patients as they go inside, most of them are really vocal about being anti both amendments and don't believe that 12 weeks is even extreme enough for them. So, yeah, the conversations that happen outside of those clinics most of the time are really around, you know, trying to convince people that it's just simply not okay to be harassing people who are going on their way into their doctor's appointment. But that has definitely shifted into more of a conversation about what's happening on the ballot this year too.
Ultimately, if the decision is not the one you want on election day, once everything is tallied up, how do you prepare yourself for that? You know, you talked about how you're preparing voters to approach their ballot, giving them the information. How do you prepare yourself for what could come?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that no matter what, we have to help people get the care they need. We know these bans don't stop abortions. They just make it more difficult to obtain them. I think, you know, we're thinking about what happens if our current 12-week ban becomes a part of our Constitution, and how we can be ready to, you know, get people where they need to go as quickly as possible. I think it's also really, you know, our work doesn't stop either way. We're going to have to keep going. And I don't think that this is the final step in the fight for either of the side.
Shelley, I appreciate your time. Thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Shelley Mann is an abortion rights advocate. We reached her in Omaha, Nebraska.
Thank you.
There's an old golf cliche about how the real challenge of the game isn't on the course, but inside your head. And Stephen Alderson talked about that on Tuesday when he described the mental discipline he had to summon to get his big first international win. But the Australian golfer also spoke about another kind of challenge. Mr. Alderson had just won a G4D tournament in Spain. G4D stands for Golf for the Disabled. And he hadn't just become the first autistic golfer to score a G4D win. He had obliterated the field, leaving his closest competitor 9 shots behind. At the post-tournament press conference, Stephen Alderson was asked about his proudest moment on the course.
Proudest moment was just staying in the moment, especially when we had that double on that hole, that lie. The lie I had in the bunker. Trent was really, really good because years ago I just would have blown up and just probably broke a club or thrown my bag or something like that. So it was really good to stay in the moment and keep positive and just try get it out the bunker and just try not to rack up an 8 or a 9 on that hole. So, and just holding that monster putt just for double just makes it better. So that was probably my most important putt in this tournament was that double bogey putt. Double bogey putt was more important than a birdie putt or that chip in on yesterday with my fairway wood off the side of the green. So, yeah.
Yeah, we were there and it was amazing.
Yeah.
You're the first autistic player to win on the G4D. Yeah. How proud does that make you?
Oh, it's so proud. Growing up as a kid, just being bullied all the time at school and even bullied at other golf clubs, it just means the world. So, awesome.
It was the Australian golfer Stephen Alderson speaking at the Real Club de Golf Soto Grande in Spain, where he had just become the first autistic golfer to win an international G4D tournament.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
Good evening. This is 91.3.